All right, let's see. I want to talk a little bit about, I am assuming that probably in the audience there is somebody who has not read the Gita. Is that a safe assumption? All right, good. We can only talk about some fairly basic thing. I assume there's some people in the audience who know the Gita fairly well, too, perhaps. Is anybody in the audience who knows the Gita fairly well? Nobody will admit it, huh? Safe. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what the Gita is on a fairly basic level, and then we'll talk about how it gets applied to our lives. Well, incidentally, the name Bhagavad Gita, Gita means song or poem. There was an Indian writer in the early years of this century whose name was Rabindranath Tagore. Is that name familiar to some of you? And one of Tagore's most famous collections of poetry is called Gitanjali. So Gita means, and that's in the name Gitanjali, it means song or poem. And Bhagavat is actually a title. It's translated in various ways into English, sometimes the Blessed One, sometimes the Lord. In fact, it is in Sanskrit a title which is used of people whom you admire and respect. They are Bhagavat. And it's also used, just as Lord is, of the gods. So it can be used both for human beings who are considered very worthy and of the gods. And so in a sense, it's then Bhagavad Gita means the Lord's song, the song of the Lord. Or it's a poem, as you might guess then from the fact that it's called Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is a poem in Sanskrit. Not very long, not by the typical length of Sanskrit works, it's not very long. It consists of 700 verses, which isn't really very many. And as a matter of fact, you can get it. This is the translation of it into English made by Annie Besant. Right? So it's, you know, get into quite a little book. Right, what else is the Gita besides a poem? Well, it's a dialogue or a conversation between two persons. And those two persons are pretty important. One of them is a fellow named Arjuna. And the other is someone named Krishna. And we'll talk about a little about these two because they're so important to the poem. Basically, Arjuna's got a problem. He doesn't know what to do. He's a little like Hamlet. Doesn't know what to do. And his friend and cousin and charioteer, somebody who's with him in a war, is Krishna. And Krishna answers Arjuna and explains to him what his problem is. And we get a kind of dialogue going. Although, as in most dialogues, one person does most of the talking. Right? And that's Krishna. Okay. All right, what else can we say about the Gita? Well, it's part of it's a short work. It's part of a very long work. Huh? It's part of one of the two great Indian epics. And that epic is called the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata is the longest book in the world, bar none. Huh? You take the Greek epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, that we're familiar with, at least by reputation. The Mahabharata is seven times longer than those two epics put together, combined. It is several times longer than the Judeo-Christian Bible. It's in 18 volumes. These are big volumes sitting on, you know, a library shelf. It's a long, long work. And so the Gita is only a very small part of it. Now, the Mahabharata itself is about a war. About a war between two groups of cousins, both of whom claim the throne. There are five cousins on one side, five brothers. And Arjuna is the middle. He's the third. He's the middle of the five brothers. Krishna is not on the other side. Krishna is a friend of both sides. Krishna is a very interesting figure in the poem. As I said, he is Arjuna's cousin. Krishna's father and Arjuna's mother were brother and sister. So that makes them first cousins. But Krishna is also something else other than just an ordinary human being. In Indian mythology, Krishna is an incarnation of the god Vishnu. Hinduism has got a trinity, just as Christianity does. little different kind of Trinity, but it's got a Trinity. Aren't Trinities fairly common in the world's religions? Stop and think about them. Do you think of any other Trinities around? Typically, a lot of Trinities consist of mother, father, and child. Think of any Trinities like that? How about Isis and Osiris and Horus? That's a typical kind of mother, father, child Trinity. They're very common in the world's mythologies. The Hindu Trinity has three persons in it. First is Brahma, who is the creator of the world. And the second is Vishnu, who preserves the world. And third is Shiva, who transforms it. Sometimes said to destroy it, but that's only half of Shiva's function. He destroys it in order that it may become something new. So he's really a transformer. All right, the middle of those three, Vishnu, incarnates from time to time in the world's history. Whenever things get particularly bad, right? whenever things sink to a very low ebb, right? Whenever evil is powerful and people are despairing, Vishnu incarnates, according to the Hindu mythology. And he is to have in all 10 incarnations. Krishna was his 8th incarnation. The Buddha was his 9th, and the 10th is yet to come. So if you all think we got bad, don't worry about it. Not nearly as bad as it's going to get. That consolation? All right. Krishna is the 8th incarnation of Vishnu. The very names of these two characters in this poem are interesting names. Arjuna means white. And Krishna means black. So you can tell just by the meanings of the names that these two characters are somehow complementary ones. Right? Why is Arjuna called the white one? What are the associations of white? Now watch it. Don't. Watch what because all colors have all sorts of associations, right? In ancient days, a candidate for initiation in the mysteries was clothed in white. That's why the candidate was called a candidate. The word candidate comes from a Latin word, candidatus, which means clothed in white. Now you figure out how that applies to political candidates and let me know. Obviously the white here, white is often symbolizes purity, huh? But it also symbolizes ignorance. It's the blank slate, right? On which nothing is written. And so, and that's what candidates were supposed to be in the mysteries. They were to be instructed. They were to be enlightened. So they themselves were blank. So Arjuna is then the candidate for initiation in this poem. Obviously, the opposite of white is black. And this is very curious because it's one of those things where the way we often think about things turns out to be not right. There's another way to look at them. We think of white, we think of black as the absence of light, don't we? Isn't that typically the case? And white we associate with light, white light, as though it were full light. But don't think about light. Think about colors as they are reflected from something. We have some white shirts around here. Why is a white shirt white? Because it reflects all the light. There is no light in it. Right? It reflects all of the light back. And we see we have something with some black trousers back there, or close to black. Why are black trousers black? Because they absorb all the light, right? So curiously enough, black is that which accepts all the light, right? Has absorbed it all, and white is that which has none of it in it. And it's in this sense that Arjuna is white. He's ignorant, uninformed, has no light in him. And Arjuna and Krishna is black because he is all-knowing. Right? He is divine. He has absorbed everything within him. All right. So far, so good. Well, as I said, the Mahabharata is about a big war, and the Bhagavad Gita takes place just at the beginning of the war. The whole Mahabharata is about all the events that lead up to the war, and it's a very complex story. It's about the war itself, and that lasts a long time in the epic. It takes a lot of books to get over it. As a matter of fact, one of the characters in the course of the war dies, and it takes him two whole books to die. He's lying on his deathbed, and he gives a speech which takes up two of the 18 books of the Mahabharata. I bet you thought operas had characters took a long time to die. Nothing compared to the Mahabharata. And then after the war, the epic deals with what the follow-up is, what the result is. But the Gita takes place just as the battle is about to begin. It's a big battle between these two groups of cousins over who is to succeed to the throne. One group of cousins are the good guys. Right? They're really splendid fellows. That's the one Arjuna belongs to. The other group are really a bunch of rascals. They're really a bunch of baddies. And they have cheated their good cousins out of the kingdom and out of the throne. And they, when I say cheated, I mean really cheated. A crooked dice game was involved in it, played with loaded dice. So it's clear which side is right and which side is wrong in this battle. There's no doubt about that. But the family has been riven, has been divided by this family quarrel. And they're about to come to blows over it. The battle is just about to begin. And Arjuna has, Arjuna's favorite weapon, his weapon of choice is the bow and arrow. And in these days, people fought from chariots. You didn't fight on your feet. That was, peons did that, right? All important people rode in a chariot. But if you're going to ride in a chariot and shoot with a bow and arrow, isn't there a little problem there? How do you control the horses, right? So consequently, every chariot has to have a charioteer. And the charioteer is a non-combatant. He doesn't do any fighting. All he does is to control the chariot for the warrior who is in it. So Arjuna's charioteer is Krishna. And there's an interesting story about that. Maybe we'll have time for a bit later. The charioteer is Krishna. And Arjuna tells Krishna, just before the battle begins, take me to the center of the field so that I may look. He wants to reconnoiter, right? Good general, wants to see what the situation is. So Krishna drives his chariot out to the center of the field, and Arjuna looks all around him, and suddenly he undergoes a crisis, a moral crisis. Arjuna at that moment realizes something he had known all along, but hadn't come home to him. Have you ever had the experience of something which you know in your brain, you know, it's intellectual knowledge, but really hasn't sunk in, and then suddenly you realize its implications, even though you've known them all along, they really come home. That's what happens to poor Arjuna. And the implications are this. He's about to go into this battle, and who is it he's fighting? His cousins, and it's even worse than that, his grandfather is on the other side. His grandfather had sworn an oath to support the throne, and the other side's got the throne, so his grandfather's over there. Even worse than that, his teacher is on the other side. And in India, the relationship between a student and a teacher is very sacred, very close. It's closer than that of parent to child, right? Because the parent begets the physical body, but the teacher begets the spiritual soul. So he's got his cousins, his uncle, grandfather's teacher, all of them. He's about to have to go out and fight them. And he's the best warrior on his side, so he's going to have to kill these people. Well, now he's got a real conflict of duty. Right? He is, by nature, a kshatriya or a warrior. India has got four castes or classes. Very sharp, very clear caste distinctions. And Arjuna belongs to the caste of the warrior. And the warrior's duty is to fight on the side of right. Right? to defend right and good against evil. And his brothers have the right. They have been harmed. They have been wronged. So it is his duty to fight for them. But isn't there another duty? The other duty is not under any circumstances to harm your relatives. Right? Family connections, very strong in India. Right? Mustn't hurt your relatives. Well, now here's poor Arjuna. He's got to do two things. Right? He's got to do something which involves two conflicting duties. You see the problem, the basic problem he's got? It's more complicated than that, but that's the basic problem. Now, is that unusual in life? Is Arjuna's problem a strange one? No. Isn't that what most of us face when we run into conflicts of one kind or another? Plato long ago said that if any human being knows what is right, they will do it. That no human being consciously chooses the wrong when there's a choice. Because the wrong always results in a bad effect to the chooser. That's the nature of things, right? That wrong involves suffering and pain and unhappiness. So nobody chooses the wrong intentionally. When people do something wrong, it's always because they are ignorant. They've made a bad choice. They don't know the difference between bad and good. But alas, is it true that most of our choices in life are between the right and the wrong? It's perfectly clear what is correct and what is not correct. No, if it were, we wouldn't have any problems, right? The fact is that almost all of our choices are murky. Life consists not of black and white, using those terms in their traditional symbolic sense, not in the sense of the Gita, right? But rather of shades of gray. And we have to make choices within that complex moral difficulty. We have to choose what is best for us and for everyone else at the moment in this circumstance. Right, that's what Arjuna has to do. And he simply doesn't know what is best. He's got a forced choice. Either he fights or he doesn't fight. And he doesn't know what the right thing is to do. All right, his choice is, so this is really a kind of paralysis of action. Right? He doesn't know what to do. So the problem is one of action. But it's more complicated than that. Because Arjuna is a very clear-sighted man. In some ways, I think Arjuna is kind of a comic figure in the poem. He's a little dull, dense in some ways. Krishna keeps telling him the same thing over and over again, and Arjuna has a hard time understanding it. He keeps saying, explain that again, won't you? But in other ways, he's very clear-sighted and very sharp. And one of the things he realizes is that ultimately, it doesn't make any difference in this war which side wins. Both are going to lose. That this is a war which is going to result in the end of civilization as Arjuna has known it. And in fact, incidentally, the chances are very good that this was a real war. Obviously, it's been elaborated by legend and mythology and all sorts of things over the years. But there probably really was a war fought, which this epic records. And it did, in fact, end Indian civilization. It marks the break between two great periods of Indian history, the heroic age of India and the modern age. Now, you all don't misunderstand what I mean by modern, because I'm a historian of language, basically. So for me, for example, modern English begins about the year 1400. So in this case, when I said modern India, this begins a couple of thousand B.C., but there was a sharp break in the kind of culture and civilization existing in India. And this war marks the breaking point. The destruction of one age and the beginning of a new one. Old Shiva is operating. Right? He's transforming. But Arjuna realizes that we've got here a war which is fratricidal. It's going to wipe out both sides, in effect. It's going to completely change the society he has always known. He didn't see any good coming out of that. To him, it simply looks like disaster awaiting. So he has not only a crisis of action, he has a crisis of faith. not faith in the sense of belief in something, but faith that good will come out of the chaos he's presently in. Or we might say, rather than faith, of confidence. Well, doesn't confidence and faith mean the same thing, essentially? Confidence has got the Latin word fido in it, which means faith. So it's essentially the same thing, but of faith or of confidence. And then his crisis has got a third aspect as well. Arjuna knows all about karma. Of course, nowadays everybody knows all about karma, don't they? It's become a commonplace of our society. It was a commonplace of Arjuna's society too. And what is meant by karma? What's involved with karma? Cause and effect. Okay, every action is a cause which has inescapably an effect. Right? There's a lot more we could say about karma, but that's kind of basic way of looking at it. Arjuna realizes no matter what he does in this battle, he's going to generate effects, right? And those effects are going to tie him to the world. And these are bad actions he's about to do. And so what is the effect of bad actions? Bad effects. So he sees himself getting all tangled in the karmic consequences of this war, and he doesn't know how to avoid them. He doesn't know how to act without getting caught in the results of this action. So this is a kind of crisis of knowledge he's got. And after he comes to this sort of triple realization, this moral crisis he has with not knowing what to do, what to believe, or what to know, how to look at it, he sinks down on the floor of his chariot, absolutely despondent, and says, Krishna, I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do. I'm not going to fight. And isn't that typical of human beings too? We call on somebody else to help us, right? Tell me what to do, and then we say, but I've already made up my mind. I'm not going to fight. That's exactly what Arjuna does. Well, Krishna at that point begins to talk to Arjuna. And all of this takes place in the first, the Gita has got 18 chapters in it. And all of this we've talked about so far takes place in the first chapter. And then the other 17 chapters, well, Arjuna gets another word in now and again. But for the most part, they are Krishna talking to Arjuna and explaining to him about these three aspects of his problem. And indeed, the book is very interestingly organized because chapters 1 to 6 are concerned with one problem, chapters 7 to 12 with another problem, and 13 to 18 with the third problem. So they really address each aspect of this moral crisis of Arjuna's. Now, we don't have time to go through the whole Gita and look at what Krishna tells Arjuna here. That's a complex process. But we'll look at it just a little bit. For one thing, with respect to action, Krishna tells Arjuna, the most important thing is that in acting, you should not be concerned with the fruit of the action. Be concerned only with the action itself. Now, what in the name of heaven can that mean? There's something which it clearly does not mean. It doesn't mean you shouldn't think about the consequences of the action. That's not the right thing to do. That's a stupid thing to do. We have to think about the consequences of an action always. But what does it mean not to be concerned about the fruit of an action? Well, there is a little story, a kind of parable, which occurs in one of the Upanishads, which says there is a tree that has in its branches two birds. One bird is busy eating the fruit of the tree, constantly eating, eating, eating. Some of the fruit is sour and tastes bad, but the bird just goes right ahead, eats it up, and gets to some more fruit. Some of the fruit is sweet and tastes wonderful, and the bird eats it, but it's not satisfied. It goes on eating. The other bird sits in the branches and merely watches and does not eat the fruit at all. There's another little story, a parable, to illustrate what is meant by fruit. And that is, there were a group of children living in a house, outside of which grew a wonderful tree. It was the tree which fulfills all wishes. And one day, an old man came to the house and said to the children, "Why are you inside the house playing with these silly little toys of yours? These little bits of wood and straw and these little rag dolls. You've got the wishing tree outside your house. All you have to do is go outside and wish, and you can have whatever you wanted." And the children laughed at him, the silly old man, and he went away. But after he went away, they started thinking, well, what's the harm of going out and trying? So they went out and they wished for things. And as soon as they wished for something, it appeared as fruit on the tree, and they could reach up and pluck it off. But one of the children, unfortunately, was a little lame boy, and he couldn't get outside. All of the other children, you know, hurried out and got around the tree, and he couldn't get in. So he could never get in to wish for anything. He could only stay on the outside of the circle and watch without ever getting in. And he watched, and he saw that his brothers and sisters and his friends were in there wishing for things, and they wished for a toy, and they got it. And what happens after a child gets a toy that it wishes for very intensely, that it really wants? Plays with it for a little while and then gets bored with it, right? And throws it away. And as the children grew older, they kept wishing for other things. They went on from toys to all sorts of things they wished for. They always appeared as fruit on the tree and fell off into the children's lap. But always, they lasted only a short time and then were broken, discarded, ceased to please, ceased to make the children happy. And the little lame boy just watched and watched and watched. And finally, the little lame boy realized that wishing for things on the tree is not the way to get happiness. It doesn't come from that. The tree is illusory, and the fruit on the tree, if one strives for it, never satisfies. To work for fruit means to do something because of what you can get out of it. Because of the hole in your belly which it will fill, like the bird in the tree, or because of you think you want it, like the children underneath the tree in the other story. To work for the sake of fruit is to do so for the satisfaction, the profit you think you can get out of the work. What's the option? Not to work for what you're going to get out of what you are working for, but to work because this is the thing to do at this time and place for the sake of the work itself. Not for the results which come, but because this is right now and here. Well, it seems like a simple thing, which Krishna tells Arjuna in this little poem. But it's a very profound thing, in fact. A very profound thing. And then we won't go through all of these, but in much detail, but Arjuna's lack of confidence or faith. Along about the middle, Krishna addresses like this. Along about the middle of the poem, Arjuna, who has thought all along of Krishna as just being his cousin, just an ordinary Joe that he knew and serving as his charioteer, he begins to realize that Krishna is really something else than that. Right? There's something remarkable here. And he says to Krishna, "Who are you really? Show me what you really..." And Krishna answers this in a long poetic way, saying, "I am this and I am that. And all of these things are the best things of their kind." or the most essential thing of their kind. And finally, Arjuna says, let me see you the way you really are. Let me see you. This is obviously not you, the real you I'm looking at. Let me see you as you really are. And Krishna shows himself in his divine form, as he really is. In fact, what he says to Arjuna is, actually, you couldn't bear to see me as I really am, but as a special gift, I will, for a moment, let you get an impression of my true form. Does that sound familiar to any biblical stories you might know about? Remember Moses? Remember Moses had a little conversation with God in the form of a burning bush. God talked to Moses out of the bush, and God told Moses, hey, you go into Egypt, and you tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Remember, and Moses said, man, I can't do that. I go there and tell Pharaoh, let your people go. He's going to say, who said so? Who are you? Moses said, you know, who is this I'm talking to? And Moses, too, eventually said, I want to see you. Huh? I want to have a look at this fellow I'm talking with. And God said, no man can look upon my face and live. But hide you in the cleft of the rock, and as I pass by, you can get a glimpse of my backside. Well, that's kind of a homey way of putting it, but that's what we see of God, right? Not his face, which no man can look upon, no one can look upon, but God's backside, which is the universe. This is sort of what Krishna tells Arjuna. You can't really look at me, but I'll give you a glimpse to suggest what I am. And at that point, Krishna, suddenly his human body swells up. It becomes gigantic. All of the stars and the suns and the comets of the universe are in his body. He is, in fact, the whole universe. There are a lot of stories about Krishna. Like, there's a wonderful story when Krishna was a little baby. He was raised by a foster mother. I won't go into that whole story. It's a little like the story of Herod in the Gospels. But Krishna was raised by a foster mother. And his foster mother began to notice that there was something a little odd about this little baby. He's, you know, 2 years old at this time. He's doing strange things that little babies don't do. And so she's feeding him one day, and when he opens his mouth for her to put in a grape, she looks in his mouth, and what she sees is the whole universe inside the little baby. All right. What Arjuna sees is the backside of God, the universe, the cosmos. And what Krishna is now telling Arjuna is not to worry, right? Not to worry. Whatever bad things happen, they will ultimately result in good in the final analysis, because there is a pattern and an order to the universe, and there is somebody looking over it. There is a law. There is a system operating. Arjuna's lack of knowledge, again, we won't go into in any significant detail at all, but what Krishna tells Arjuna is, in effect, all about how the universe is organized and how it relates to the cosmos and to him. And we get kind of an outline of Hindu philosophy, particularly the kind of philosophy known as Sankhya, all compressed into a few chapters of the poem. Well, at the end then, Arjuna has, in fact, is a very moving speech at the end. What Arjuna really needs in this is to know what his duty is. Isn't that what he started? He had a conflict of duties, and he didn't know what his duty was. Now, in Sanskrit, the word for which we translate as duty is dharma. Huh? That's the Sanskrit word we usually translate it as duty. Actually, that's only one possible translation for the word dharma. The word dharma means lots and lots of things. As a matter of fact, it even gets reflected in the motto of the Theosophical Society. The motto of the society is an English translation of a Sanskrit motto. And we translate the motto as, there is no religion higher than truth. But in fact, the word which we translate as religion is, in the Sanskrit, Dharma. And that's one of the meanings of Dharma is, you see the connection between religion and duty? And if you know anything about Buddhism, in Buddhism it is said that there are three essentials to Buddhism. One is the Buddha himself, and the next is the Dharma, our teaching, our religion of the Buddha, and the third is the order, the order of monks, which the Buddha established. So Dharma can mean religion, but it's a word with very rich meanings, and its essential meaning, however, its core meaning is this. Each of us has within us our own personal, individual, special Dharma. And that Dharma is, in fact, the core of our being. It's what is really us. And the word Dharma really means the essential nature or the true identity of anything. Now, the thing about duty is that the English word duty has got a real bad press. Don't think duty is a bad word? And if I say to you, it is your duty to do this, is your reaction normally to jump up and down and say, oh, whoopee, that's my duty? No, what we think of duty as meaning is you have to. It's something which is imposed on us from outside. Isn't that our concept of duty? An obligation imposed from outside. That's not what Dharma means at all. Dharma means action which comes naturally and inevitably from inside us, right? Because it springs from the core of our being. Right? It's what our essential nature makes inevitable. So it's my Dharma to do something. It's not because somebody has said, hey, you got to do this. If it's my Dharma to do it, it's because my nature is such that that's the way I fulfill my nature, is by acting in that particular way. So essentially then, if we want to know what our duty is, what do we have to find out first? Who we are, right? To know what we should do, we must know who we are. And if we know who we are, then we know what we should do, and there's no problem. So what Arjuna has to find out in this poem is who he is. And this whole poem is the story of Arjuna's discovery of who he really is. And of course, who does he find out that he is in the course of the poem? Anybody guess? Krishna. Arjuna is the human, Krishna is the divine. There you go. What Arjuna discovers in the course of the poem is that he really is Krishna, that they are the same, they are one. And this discovery then allows him to act and act freely, because he is acting with the divine will within him, the divine intention. Okay, well, that in general is sort of the way the book goes. I might say that at the end of the book, Krishna gives Arjuna a warning. He says, now, wait a minute, be careful. Be real careful about what I have just told you. Don't go around telling people about this unless you're sure that they will understand it. Because what I have told you is exceedingly easy to misunderstand. And are there people who misunderstand that kind of thing? Yeah, of course. It's very easy to suppose that, well, what we happen to want is what God wants. Right? And that's what Krishna is warning about here. You must really make careful, be sure about this. Don't go off and mistake what you're doing, because maybe all you're doing is eating the fruit off the tree. Or maybe all you're really doing is wishing under the tree. Be very clear about this. But it's a wonderful little book, and as I said, a very powerful book, which has been very effective, very influential, not just in Indian society. In Indian society, the Gita is what the Gospels are in European society. It holds exactly a comparable position. Many Indians recite portions of the Gita every day of their lives, in particular at the end of chapter 2 the last 18 verses. I don't know if you've noticed, 18 is a very significant number here. There are 18 chapters in the Gita. There are 18 volumes of the Mahabharata. At the end of chapter 2 of the Gita, there are 18 verses which are referred to, which are called the sage of stable mind. Krishna has just told Arjuna that, you know, what you really need to do is to be a sage, a wise person, right? With a stable, a firm, a fixed mind. And Arjuna says, well, no, okay, that's fine. How do I know what this kind of person is like, right? Tell me. And don't give me, Arjuna says, any of your big abstractions. Tell me how the sage of stable mind walks and talks and sits. How do I know a sage of stable mind when I see one? And Arjuna's answer are these 18 verses, which are called the sage of stable mind. Those were recited by Gandhi every day of his life. He used those in his morning meditation. Particularly 17 particularly nice verses. The book then has been very influential in Indian society. But not only that, it's been influential in the West and in America. Indirectly, if not directly. Have any of you tried reading the Gita? Have any of you read the Gita? If you're reading the Gita for the first time, you've got to get past certain things, right? Which are really difficult to get past. Because the Gita is strange. The story in which it is set, and which is integral to it, takes place 5,000 years ago, maybe, on the other side of a globe, in a society very different from ours, an exotic world, full of exotic, strange customs, very different. And you've got to get through all of that, because that's there in the Gita. That's the way the Gita is expressed. But were people 5,000 years ago on the other side of the world so very different from us in their fears and hopes and desires and needs? And I think they weren't. Human beings are essentially the same all over the world and always have been. And so this book, beneath that very exotic exterior, which you've got to get through, is dealing with fundamental problems that you and I relate to. And so it is a book for our time as well as their time. And in fact, it is a book for all times. I hope you all enjoy it. Thank you. Yeah.
When was the book written?
Actually, we don't really know. And almost anything in India, it's hard to say when it was written. Sometimes you can tell when it was written, but not when it was composed. These are often two different things, right? Because early Indian society was an oral society in which things were passed on mouth to ear, right? Long before they got written down. The form, and scholars who simply look at the language of the Gita, right? And they look at some of the customs in it, and they try to date it according to anthropological, cultural anthropology, and according to linguistic criteria, vary widely. And the dates run anywhere from about 500 BC to 500 AD, over a whole thousand-year period. But sort of in that range is where the language of the poem, and that's mainly its language that that's based on, the language of the poem indicates somewhere about roughly 2,000 years ago. But the events that it's dealing with are a couple of thousand years older than that, almost certainly. And probably the poem itself has in it lots of elements that are far older, much older, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Translation that was Oppenheimer quoting, his famous quote.
You have to know what the famous quote is. I'm afraid I don't know it.
Well, when J. Robert Oppenheimer, when they exploded the first atom bomb, he said,
right.
I am become death,
right.
Shatterer of worlds. This
right.
is Krishna
right.
Admonishing the prince to
right.
do his duty.
Sure. Yeah, I remember now.
But Prabhavananda's translation, yeah. which is the one I read, didn't
uh-huh.
have it that
way. Offhand, I don't know. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of English translations of the Gita now, and I don't know which one Oppenheimer used. I know where the passage came from, though. As a matter of fact, it is from that vision which I mentioned to you here, right? When Krishna shows himself to Arjuna, and he is the cosmic form. And at the end of that, there are lots of things we didn't touch on here this evening. At the end of that vision, Krishna opens his mouth, and all of the opposing army, all of Arjuna's enemies, come flowing in to Krishna's mouth, and he swallows them down. And then he opens his mouth, and Arjuna sees all of his friends come flowing into Krishna's mouth. And obviously this is not some kind of punishment which is going on. This is everything returning to its primal source, which is the divine reality. And that's the passage that quotation comes from. Yeah, it's a very powerful passage at that point. There are a couple of places in the Gita, as many times as I've read the Gita, there are a couple of places I still to this day cannot read or even think about without feeling tingling of the flesh, because they're so powerful. And that's one of them, that scene at the end of the vision of the divine form. All sorts of translations around. I myself, personally, usually use Annie Besant's translation. And maybe that's only because it was the first translation of the Gita I ever read, so I have sort of a sentimental attachment to it. But not entirely. Annie Besant's translation is quite literal. It's very close to the Sanskrit, but it is also, because Annie Besant was a very good stylist, she wrote very well, it's also fairly smooth to read. So it both has literary quality and literal accuracy. So I like her translation real well. And I brought along two translations, the little one by Annie Besant, you know, which I showed you at the beginning, and that I think is real nice. And then this one, which is also a favorite of mine, by a fellow named Winthrop Sargent. What Winthrop Sargent does is to give, he does it, on each page is one stanza of the poem. He gives it in the Devanagari, you know the funny way Indian Sanskrit is written? It's written with a very funny alphabet. He gives it in the Sanskrit alphabet, which is called Devanagari, and then he gives it in transliteration in good old Latin alphabet, in case you can't read Devanagari, right? And then he gives a word-by-word gloss, translates each word separately, and then he gives a translation for the whole verse, and then, bless his soul, on the other side, he takes each word and breaks it down into its parts and tells you what its grammatical composition is. And so you can read Sanskrit without knowing any Sanskrit with the help of Sargent's edition. So it's a delightful work for that reason. You can suddenly become very knowledgeable about Sanskrit by using Sargent. But there are lots of them, and many, many good ones. I think each one is useful for some alternative purpose. And I think, in fact, the best thing to do if you're reading the Gita, if you want to study the Gita, is to take a couple of translations, two or three of them, and put them side by side and use them together. Because there's an old Italian saying that you may know, traduttore, traduttore. It's a pun in Italian. It doesn't work very well in English, but it means the translator is a traitor. Every translator distorts meaning. It's inevitable. So you use several translations and they correct one another. You get a better idea of what the original is like. Assuming, of course, you don't read Sanskrit yourself. Okay. Yes, sir.
You summarize the teachings, the Krishna's answer to the crisis of action, the crisis yeah. of faith.
Yeah.
Did you summarize the crisis of knowledge?
No, I didn't really. I didn't really. Partly because it's very... It's hard to summarize, is the truth of the matter, because as I said, he gives a kind of overview of one school of Indian philosophy called the Sankhya, how it views the world. And if any of you are familiar with Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, there's a lot of similarity, because what it does is it relates the world of experience, the sensory world of experience, to the ultimate world of reality. Tries to show how these two are related. And that's a complicated thing to do. So it gets into things like the gunas, or is that term familiar? In Indian philosophy, all matter is composed of three qualities or strands, which are called gunas. And incidentally, this is modern physicists have gotten really interested in this. We get into the quark theory, because it turns out some of the threefold aspects of quarks are a little like gunas. So some really interesting connections there. But it gets into all of these things in Indian philosophy, and it's a kind of summary book Exactly. It's an ontology. It's exactly what it is. It's a kind of ontology. In poetry. Yeah.
What will we be doing in the Tuesday classes?
Yeah, well, who knows? in the Tuesday classes, I thought what we would do, since there are six of them, I thought we would devote, and this book falls into three parts. Right? I thought we would devote two classes to each of the three parts of the book. Sort of looking at, kind of outlining the book and seeing what goes on. So we'll cover about three chapters, a meeting, and looking at what's in the book. Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening.